Hello and welcome to Poetic Synergy. I'm Dáithí Ó-Chiarán. This week's programme will explore the work of Michael Hartnett, poet and translator, and in particular, we'll look at the Eastern influences upon his work. I'm joined by Lucy Collins, lecturer in English at UCD, who specialises in contemporary Irish poetry. I'm joined by John McDonough, lecturer in English at Mary Immaculate College, Limerick, and co-author with Stephen Newman of Remembering Michael Hartnett, which was published by Four Courts Press. And also on the panel today is John Cusson, Newcastle Westman and friend of Michael Hartnett. You're all very welcome to the programme.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dáithí.
Could I start with John Cusson? John, you were a friend of Michael Hartnett. Could you tell our listeners what Michael was like as a person and as a friend?
Well, we grew up together in Newcastle West and went to the local primary school together, and we were on friendly terms. That would be back in the late 40s and early 50s. And what can you say about Michael? He was small, I suppose, and he was kind of impish, and he had always a great sense of humour. In later years then, of course, when he became a poet, he never changed. And the one thing I can remember about Michael is he didn't take himself very seriously. He had a great sense of humour and he was always cracking jokes. He was a very amiable character. And of course, he was at his best sitting down behind a pint of Guinness. And drink was very much part of Michael, and, you know, having a few drinks and good fun and chat. And if he went into a bar, by the end of the night, he'd know everybody in the bar and he'd be on good terms with them. He was an extremely sociable man when he was out and about, without a doubt.
Now, John McDonough, when Michael was 22, he wrote a poem called The Tau. I wonder, could you explain how he came to write it?
Well, in the book we published, Dáithí, Gabriel Rosenstock wrote a very interesting article on The Tau. And in it, he describes Michael's journey. He was only 21 when he wrote The Tau. And according to Gabriel, he regards that as one of his most underestimated works. The Tau itself, I think, was written roughly around 400 BC, as far as people can tell. And what Gabriel did was he wrote a Tau to Michael. And in it, he uses this phrase, which I think is lovely. He says, to know the utter mildness and wildness of your ways is to become like you. And what Gabriel has to say about Hartnett's Tau is that it becomes more than just a poem, but actually a way of life. He actually is very funny. He called it the most useless thing imaginable. Cow dung has more use if it is not lived. So for him, the Tau is more than just a fashioned poem. It's actually a way of life and a philosophy.
Yeah, and when you were saying that, Lucy was nodding. What's your perspective on the Tau as a poem and maybe the philosophy behind it, Lucy?
Well, I think it's interesting that Hartnett himself, in a sense, kind of disavowed philosophy as a category, in the sense that he said he didn't want to adopt another man or woman's philosophy. But it's interesting that the Eastern philosophies, I think, allow him to actually to connect with ideas in a more organic way, rather than simply adopting, you know, a modern philosophy wholesale. So it allows him both his own creativity, if you like, his own originality in a sense, to come through even in a translation. And it is interesting, I think, that this was written so early in Hartnett's career, because it does prefigure a lot of his interests, particularly the interweaving of the spiritual and the representation of nature, for example, that we see right through Hartnett's career. And it's a very important kind of prefiguring of that interest, I think.
And John McDonough in Limerick, I just wonder, could we look at when Michael Hartnett looked at the Tau poem and the interweaving and the originality of spirit and nature in Eastern philosophy, and from his own experience as a person who grew up in Ireland, I just wonder what spiritual themes come out of the Tau work.
Well, what I find very interesting, Dáithí, is the blend you get in Hartnett's work of, as you say, a mysticism that's heavily influenced by the East, but also a very grounded and rooted mysticism of the local. That you get in his Inchicore haiku, for example, poets reflecting Eastern philosophies, but also very rooted in the pubs, in the people, in the bricks and mortar of where he lived. And that, for me, is the great contrast in Hartnett's work, in poems that are very personal, very tragic, very sad, and he was always very honest. That's one of the things I always like about Hartnett's poetry, is a tremendous honesty in the work, and he's not afraid to confront his own demons. Uh-huh. And yet the mysticism for him, I think, is an escape. It allows him a form of release. And I think one of the reasons perhaps that he chose the haiku, for example, which of course is a Japanese form, one of the reasons I think he chose that was he was finding writing difficult at the time in the mid-80s, and the haiku gives you a form, a ready-made form, and a structure and a discipline. And I think he liked that. So the mysticism, I think, for Hartnett was not necessarily, well, it was a form of escape, but it was also a form of discipline. It gave him a structure and a focus in his work.
And I wonder, before we get into the haiku and maybe the sadder part of his life later in life, I wonder, Lucy, what is the beauty that strikes you in the poem that you wrote about the Tao and its connection to spirituality, mysticism and nature?
One of the things he dwells on a lot in the poem is the issue of control. And at one point he says, I cannot control life, I am controlled. And that whole dynamic of giving yourself up to another force, if you like, to another structure, is very important, I think, in that poem. And I think part of its beauty is that idea, is the serenity, in a way, that it creates, which we might see as kind of unusual perhaps for Hartnett, especially such a young man. But it's an extraordinary kind of relinquishing of all the conflicts and tensions of the world. This sense of relinquishing the self, relinquishing the ego, really, is a very important thing. But it's an interesting thing, too, because it runs counter to what we might expect of the artist or the poet. And in lots of Hartnett's poems, he dwells on the idea of the writer and the poet very strongly. And yet at this point, he seems able to sort of give that up and give himself over to a larger force.
John Cusson. In that Tao poem, he says, I sit outside my door or my porch, I'm paraphrasing now, in all seasons. What was it like to be with him through the seasons as a friend and a hunter, actually, Michael was as well?
Well, that's a hard question. I mean, I knew Michael and I mightn't have seen him in all seasons like that, I'm afraid. Mostly when I met Michael, it was in a pub. A lot of the chat would be about anything except poetry and mysticism and Eastern philosophy, I'm afraid.
But that shows you the sense of balance that maybe had. And for you, Lucy, what message does he give to writers?
Well, I think in these poems, it's the simplicity of the style, which is really the key dimension. And it's an interesting contrast to some of Hartnett's later work, which especially work that is more polemical or more political in its message, and where sometimes the form sort of gets a little out of control, whereas this, it's the simplicity and the control of it, which is the key thing. But it's interesting, say, in Tao, where at one point he says, I have no form, I cannot speak. You know, that strange sense that self-expression is linked to form and also to kind of precision of form in that way. And in the Si Kong Tu Walks in the Forest, there's one bit where it says, create but do not grow less. And that sort of sense of creativity as this delicate balance between sort of increasing the self and depleting the self, you know, which comes through in the simplicity of the language, in the very fine line, I think, that Hartnett walks between the descriptive element, the observant element, where he's, you know, bringing the world into the poem, if you like, and the one where he's eliminating the material, you know, and getting back down to the essence of the human being, you know, and it's that delicate kind of balance, I think, which he's trying to get in the words.
We actually have a voice clip of Michael talking about the ability to amalgamate sounds and music. Maybe we just listen to that for a moment.
My father was a great singer, and I should say he wasn't a great singer, but he sang a lot. And he had all these old Dangerous Dan McGrew and all the Robert Service stuff and all the old ballads, 1798 and all that, constantly. And Victorian drawing room songs, you know. Believe me, if all those endearing young charms and all that. So the house was always full of music. That's my parents' house, you know. But it was full of a different side of music. I mean, I discovered Elvis Presley when I was 16 or 17, whenever. I was thrilled. Buddy Holly and all that. But there were Kayleys on every night in the town, and the mixture was extraordinary, I suppose. There were no divisions, you see. If you stood up and sang a song in Irish, or if you sang a song, I got stung by a sweet honeybee, Elvis, nobody took objection. Sounds contradictory, I suppose. There was no tradition there. But there was an amalgamation of all traditions. There was no definite simple tradition. It was a mixture of everything, you know, people playing saxophones at the dance hall, or the box, or the fiddle. But we didn't differentiate between them at all. We were just there.
And John Cusson, because you were around at that time, can you reflect back on that openness and acceptance, I suppose, of everybody and every expression, musical or otherwise?
Well, I could safely say I think Newcastle West was a very democratic town, and there wasn't much class distinction or anyone. Everyone was kind of mucking in together, as one might say. And I know exactly what Michael is saying there, when you might have somebody singing a bit of opera, and you might have somebody singing a bawdy ballad, and you might have Moore's melodies, and that kind of, what would you call it, eclectic mix or something like that. I can sympathise with that. I empathise with that entirely. Yeah, you know exactly where he's coming from there, you know.
And Lucy, you were talking about his ability to shape and to form poems. He has a poem, a translation of a poem by Maribon, A Hermit Speaks, and it's a 7th century Irish poem. But he has this ability, just like he's talked about in the music and John has referred to there, is to be able to blend perspectives and cultures and also find the connective in them. I just wonder, what do you think?
He obviously had a great affinity with those earlier Irish poets, and in part it very much taps into what we spoke about a moment ago in terms of his love of nature and his love of the environment, and that comes through very strongly in this poem. But there is also the sense in which there is a connection, in a sense, between the Taoist and the Druidic, in a way, in Hartnett's work, I think. And so there's a sense, too, of how the environment is shaped by the human inhabitation of it, whether it's at the level of community or at the level of the solitary being in this poem. And so obviously, while he is devoted to nature, he's also always thinking about the relationship between the human being and the natural environment. It's always in that relationship that the key expression occurs, I think.
And maybe John McDonagh, it's this ability to see the human aspect of all our I would say all of our experiences with the environment, with ourselves as people, and our growth and our journey through life, is maybe that's the synergistic effect of his exploration of Eastern forms.
Absolutely, Dahi. I think for me, I think Hartnett's strongest poetry are the poems of self-analysis. One poem that I remember reading years ago that still very much sings to me today is that actor Kiss, where he describes his father's death and kissing his father for the first and last time. And within the poem, there's such a simple progression, but such a powerful personal analysis and an honesty. And when you come back to the Tao, this notion of the journey of life, that life is a series of events, and we have to learn from each single small event, reflected in nature, but also reflected in the people that we meet. And there is this very strong sense in Michael's work, I get at least, of him attempting to understand himself, attempting to understand where he came from, the people of Newcastle West, of Glanton, of moving to Dublin, of everywhere he went, he brought this openness and this simplicity with him. And that, for me, is where the strength in his poetry lies. And in the introduction to our book, Seamus Heaney refers to this as well, that he said Hartnett's openness to the world around him is a gift, as he called it. But it's a troubled gift. It's a gift that gives you an openness to experience which can be painful. But it also is a gift that opens your eyes to the beauty and the joy around you.
And we actually have a lovely clip, clip 4, where Hartnett talks about that kiss.
I kissed my father as he lay in bed in the ward. Nurses walked on soles of sleep, and old men argued with themselves all day. The 7 decades locked inside his head congealed into a timeless, leaking heap. The painter lost his sense of all but grey. That actor kiss fell down a shaft too deep to send back echoes that I would have prized. 29 was 41, was 84, all the one in his kaleidoscopic eyes. He willed to me his bitterness and thirst, his cold ability to close the door. Later, over a drink, I realised that was our last kiss, and alas, our first. Let the dead rest.
I'm going to move the the Eastern focus a little bit now. He was also highly influenced by Pasternak. And Pasternak, I think one in his collection, A Farewell to English, Michael Hartnett referred to Pasternak's bullets, John McDonagh. Would you have a perspective on that?
On Pasternak and the influence. As you say, in The Farewell, there's just one line from the Farewell I'd just like to read. It said, "I will not see great men go down who walked in rags from town to town, finding English a necessary sin, the perfect language to sell pigs in." And there's a great analysis here of the combination that can be offered by Irish and by English. Now, in terms of Pasternak, I suppose I think Lucy would probably be the one who might have more expertise in that area than me.
Okay, but I'm going to go more local than that now.
Second,
I'm going to ask John Cusson a question, because it's a real, for me, that English is a perfect language to sell pigs in is a real Limerick metaphor, because like I'm actually a Limerick man, and my ancestors who sell pigs in Limerick, and it was a bacon town. John, I just wonder what you think about selling pigs through English. What would that mean for you?
Yeah, I don't like that line at all, actually. I'd rather not talk about it. I think it's not one of his better efforts. I think it's a kind of a throwaway line. I know it's quoted, but I don't like it. I'd rather to get back to Pasternak. And Michael was a great socialist, mightn't be well known. And when I say a socialist, he was actually a supporter of the Labour Party. And his father was also a supporter of the Labour Party in Newcastle West. His father was a house painter. And Michael actually was an election agent for Ned O'Dwyer, who went forward for the Labour Party in Newcastle West back in the 70s. And Michael tramped the lanes of West Limerick looking for votes for Ned O'Dwyer. Now, I'm sorry to say, but the Labour Party wasn't the flavour of the month in West Limerick. And Ned O'Dwyer never got elected. But that's just a reason that maybe Pasternak appealed to him, sort of that kind of socialism that Pasternak, real socialism, we'll say, that Pasternak. And, of course, one should also mention that he called his daughter Lara after the heroine in Pasternak's novel, Dr. Zhivago. I'm sorry now, I'd rather not talk about pigs.
Okay, that's okay. And what you've contributed about Pasternak is really brilliant. And it's a pity we don't have John Bowman on the panel, because in my reflective memory, there was always one Fianna Fáil and two Fine Gael returns in West Limerick, and you could put your house in it. So to actually support the Labour Party was a rebel act in Limerick.
They used to say if Fianna Fáil put up a tailor's dummy in West Limerick, he'd be elected.
We won't say nothing about the hill and Randy Fail about that. What are your reflections on Pasternak's influence, Lucy?
I do think that John Cusson's point about the politics is very interesting, because it seems that a lot of Hartnett's engagement with European writing, and also his devotion to Lorca, the way, you know, he talks about having gone to Madrid and learned Spanish purely to be able to translate Lorca, is attached to this connection between the artistic and the political, and the idea that it is possible for art, you know, the highest forms of art, to transmit political meanings without being necessarily polemical or reductive in their political messages. And so he obviously did reach for models like Pasternak and Lorca that were able to combine that in a subtle way. And I think the best of his poetry does that as well, you know, combines that sense of and the very interesting information about his involvement in Labour politics. You know, it sheds very interesting light on the poems, because there is a real lived sense of that political engagement. And after all, Hartnett was all about the idea of experience and, you know, authentic writing rather than theoretical or writing in that sense. And so his direct involvement, I think, in that political area would be very important in terms of shaping his literary tastes as well as his own writing.
And there's echoes of the first poem we looked at there, because it's about living what you say.
Mm-hmm,
and
exactly,
he definitely was the bravest of people in that regard.
Just to maybe touch on the haiku just for a little second. One of the strong features I get from the haiku are, of course, these natural images. I remember hearing a description that a haiku is almost, if you can imagine, standing under a leaf and a drop falls from the leaf and the drop falls in front of your eye, and it expands, it magnifies the world for a split second as it passes your eye. And in that, you have moments of great clarity, and then that moment is absolutely gone. And in essence, I think in Michael's work, that's the function of nature. But again, in some ways it reminds me of Ted Hughes, that it's a violent nature also, that it's not necessarily a benign nature that Michael describes. He has one beautiful line about, for there is an Ireland where trees suddenly fly away and leave their pigeons standing in the air, baffled. And I love this image of the surprise that nature can bring. That when you see these very content pigeons sitting in trees, wouldn't it be lovely if the tree disappeared rather than the pigeon? And I think for me, that's the kind of essential Hartnett spin on nature. That one of Michael's, I think, one of his key philosophies is that poetry is a rebel act, and that poetry should be constantly seeking, not to upset, but to explore the strangeness of life and to explore the difficulties of life. And that comes across for me very strongly in his use of nature, that it is a celebration of the beauty of the countryside, of course, but it's also a darker side of life as well.
And maybe we just stay there for the moment, Lucy. Michael has brought in the haikus there, and in some sense it's like the loneliness and the darkness of some periods in our life are reflected in the intercore haiku. I wonder what strikes you from reading them.
Well, I think, I mean, obviously they were written at a very difficult time in Michael's life. And as I think John McDonough mentioned earlier, one of the virtues of that extreme control of the haiku form and its minimalism is that it does give order to the chaos, if you like. One of the interesting things that the sequence also allows, and it's interesting too, if we link it back to the Tao that we discussed earlier, because Hartnett's interest in the sequence as a form allows him to combine some of these elements we've been talking about, particularly both ideas of personal despair and self-reflection that has a very dark side to it, but also political and social commentary too. And he's able to combine those with the representation of nature or the environment. And obviously in intercore haiku, he takes the haiku form, which traditionally used the seasons and natural imagery at its heart. And he turns that into an urban, a set of urban images. And that interweaving that goes on in that sequence between those three elements, between the environment, between the personal dimension and the political, is really crucial, I think, to his choice of it at that time.
We have a recording of Michael from the intercore haikus. Maybe we could just listen to that for a moment.
A domestic crisis came upon me and I left County Limerick and I found myself living in Inchicore in Dublin. My English dam bursts and I'll swallow all my bastards. Irish shakes its head. I was on my own, wifeless, childless, houseless, among great friends indeed, but I was going through this turmoil all the time, writing in Irish, speaking English, thinking in English, but dreaming in Irish. So one day I sat down and wrote a few hundred lines in English after 10 years. Now, again, on course of the Gawcorder came up. What am I to do with these? They are my legitimate offspring. Inchicore Haiku, the book was called. If I publish them, I'll be condemned by both sides for breaking my vow, for going back to English. So I said, you wrote them. To quote the motto of a famous English newspaper, publish and be damned. I did.
And we looked in the haikus at the personal and the political. I remember in the intercore haikus, he heard the Angelus bell ring. And it was a new automatic bell was chiming the Angelus. And just working from memory now, he said something, there's the automatic Angelus bell.
Electric Angelus.
Electrical Angelus.
Another job gone.
Another job gone. So even, he never lost his political sense, even in his darkest hour. You were sort of frowning at me there, John.
Well, Don, you robbed me, unfortunately, of that haiku.
Oh, I'm sorry,
I was going to say, that's one of my favourite ones on the haiku, because what I love about intercore haiku is the focusing on the city, because so many writers and other poets reflect on Hartnett's use of nature. But, of course, intercore haiku is all about a city and urban life. And In urban life, you have concrete, you have buildings, you have pubs, you have churches, you have and a far greater range of people. And that poem is it just says, "From St. Michael's Church, the electric Angela's, another job gone." It's fantastic because it says so much. It's not just about a changing Ireland, but it's Hartnett almost throwing his hands up at the change. And it actually reminds me of a line. I was down at the Kennelly Festival once in Ballylongford, and I met the late Desmond Fitzgerald, the Knight of Glynn, and he said he met Michael Hartnett when Michael was working as a telephonist in Dublin. And this got Michael's humour from Perry. He was working at night time in Dublin as a telephonist, you know, pushing in the buttons. And when the Knight of Glynn met him, he said, "Oh, hello, I'm the Knight of Glynn." And he said, "Oh, hello, I'm Michael Hartnett, Knight Telephonist." and for me, I thought that was just great, just pulling the rug from under the Lord. And it gets Michael's humour as well. And there's an awful lot of humour, I think, in the haiku as well, although he was going through personally a very difficult time. For example, another one of my favourites is, "What do bishops take when the price of bread goes up? A vow of silence." And again, the socialism is coming in. I think the social critique is coming in, but also it's laced with I think some good humour.
Yeah, and John Cusson, you're having a good laugh there.
Well, I was thinking of the story of, that John talked about the Knight of Glynn, and we were unveiling a statue to Garrod Éireann, one of the Earls of Desmond, in Newcastle West many years ago, and Michael was there, and he met the Knight of Glynn there, and he sort of said, "Now I'm going to become like Dahi O'Brother. I'm going to become your poet, you see." And I met Desmond the Knight sometime later, and he said, "Michael Hartnett has become my poet, you know. I'll tell you one thing about it, damned expensive."
Okay. And let's leave the last words to Michael Hartnett himself.
"My father plays a great part about it because I was his first son, and I saw him in good times and bad times. And my mother's influence is quite strong, but I've never been led to write about her. I don't know why. Just can't. Bridie was a dangerous, malicious gossip. I was mad about her. She was a great woman. She was a great stirrer up of mud. Terrible, very dangerous lady. But she was a mixture of the two, man. That means I'm dangerous, cantankerous, cranky, a stirrer up of shite, and a poet. When you put them all together, you have a dangerous little bundle."
So, thank you all so much. Lucy Collins, John Cusson, and John McDonough, thank you all so much. And we'd also like to thank Power Productions for the audio clips of Michael Hartnett's voice from the documentary Muinke Drolini or A Necklace of Wrens. I'm Dáithí O'Ciarán, and thanks for listening. This programme has been kindly funded through the Sound and Vision Scheme, which is a funding scheme from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.